No taxation without representation. 200 years of exploitation in the capital of this nation. No representation in the capital of this nation. 200 years of exploitation. Give the people their right to vote.
Someone asked me, was it true? The voting rights of the district were long overdue.
That was Sweet Honey in the Rock with That's Give right. the People the Right to Vote. Hello and welcome to Shadow Politics, an hour-long grassroots talk show that will attempt to shine a light on the issues that you care about. I'm your host, United States Senator Michael D. Brown, coming to you live from the District of Columbia, America's last colony. I'm joined by my co-host, Maria Sanchez, and together we hope our show will start a dialogue with America about the issues that are important to you and affect the lives of all of us. Unfortunately, on today's show, you won't be able to call in because we're pre-recording because of all the activities that are going on this weekend on the 58th anniversary of the original March on Washington. Tonight, we have a very special guest with us, Phil Portlock, who's a photographer, a filmmaker, and a social justice activist here in Washington, D.C. You know, I've been involved in this civil rights struggle in the District of Columbia for 15 years. Phil has been involved in the civil rights struggle in America for more than 50 years. So we can't, although he doesn't look it, I got to tell you, but we can't wait to hear what he has to say. Maria, welcome to the show. I hope your part of California is not on fire.
That is correct. It's not. And our hearts go out to all those. I have a colleague that she was displaced from the Camp Fire, and now she's being displaced from the Dixie Fire. So it's, well, and our own Deborah is affected by it, too.
Yeah,
also the same. And Doug and Don. And we know people well. So, yes. And I'm really curious because I know that our guest, Phil Portlock, and was present yesterday. And after you introduce him again, let's talk first about what that was like yesterday for both of you.
Okay. Welcome, Phil. Thanks for being on the show.
Thank you, Mike and Maria and Don and the whole staff. I'm honored to join you all this afternoon. And I want to, Mike, Senator Mike, I just first want to just take a moment to thank you, Anise, Karen, and all those who have struggled so long to gain some kind of justice for the residents of the District of Columbia where statehood is concerned. And I mean that because you all have been in the forefront, and it's really been a long, hard struggle. And I personally thank you. I've been in many ways in that same struggle. But we just want to take that time to thank you for the work that you've been doing, Mike.
Well, you're very kind, Phil, to say that. And I know you've been in the struggle a long time. And I've got to tell you, when I first started, I went to a hearing where I met one of my heroes, Dorothy Height. And I took her hand and her big floppy blue hat and introduced myself. And she said just what you said. Thank you for your hard work and the struggle. And I came home to my wife and I said, I cannot believe that Dorothy Height is thanking me. You know, that may have been the greatest honor of my life. She was such an incredible person. But you're an incredible person too, Phil. And let's start out. But I'll tell the audience what I did yesterday. But first, you tell me what you did yesterday, how you were involved yesterday.
Okay. Yes, yesterday was one of many of the March on Washington celebrations or observances have been taking place. I will have to say that in the early years, I'd say I was at the, I know I was at the 1993 because the first one was at on August 1963, and there wasn't one in 73, but the next one was in 93. So I have been to each of those, when I say each of those, where I physically have been there and really you know, was clear what these marches are, what they mean and what they're all about. And yesterday, I had just had cataract surgery in my left eye about maybe a little over a week ago. And I debated whether I was going to do this because I was on several drops. You know, if anyone who's had, any of you have had the cataracts, you know, you have to maintain these drops for a whole week, and then you have a return to the ophthalmologist for a final result. I got that last week, Wednesday of this past week. So I felt a little more comfortable in attempting to do this. But then I just turned 80 years old on July 12th, so I've been doing this many, many years. And my wife was concerned, Pat was concerned about me going down in the heat, you know, with the high temperature and humidity. And she relented, and she's just been a tremendous support for me because I have not been able to drive for some months now because of the poor vision. And so she drove me down, and on the way down, I will just say this quickly. I had a little moment where I shed some tears, and this was not like any other of these observances that I had been a part of, because I was dealing with the fact that this yesterday was the anniversary of young brother Emmett Till's killing in Money, Mississippi on that day in 1955. I was thinking about him. And then the other thing, I was thinking about the fact that that was a sad part. And then I got angry because I said, I'm going down here today, not because I'm just going to honor the 63 March on Washington, the original one where Dr. King became so famous with his I Have a Dream speech, but the fact that I was going down as an African-American to not only look at this celebration and the importance of this day, but also to look and see that the whole forefront or the structure or the key to a democracy is the right to vote, and seeing that that at this time is being challenged like it has been in so many years. And that was the thing that left me with some frustration and anger. And that drove me to even want to be there even more so than if it were just going to be an observance. And so I went down sad, and I went down with anger within me as an African-American man, and to have to live through this for so many years, and then at this time see that we're having so many states, and I know we're not nonpartisan, but I'm your station is not, but I have to just say that what is happening as far as this threat to the black vote, and it's not just the black vote, it's the vote that's being threatened by, that will affect, I think, all Americans if this continues. And so I would normally have gone down to McPherson Square where the gathering began, but I knew I would not be able to walk from that location down to the mall. So Pat dropped me off at 7th and Constitution right near the stage where a lot of the participants at Farragut McPherson would eventually end up. So I spent most of my time there yesterday. I was there for about 2.5, close to 3 hours. Mm-hmm. And I listened to the speeches. I talked with many of our young people to see just whether they understood what this whole thing of voting was about, and also this whole issue of statehood, because they are intricately connected. Because my feeling is, if we can't have, if we don't have a certain makeup of the White House and the Congress, there's not a great chance that we will gain statehood for the District of Columbia, which to me, after all these years, it's really outrageous that it doesn't exist and that we're asking to pay so much taxes to serve in the nation's wars, on juries, all those things. And I know this, you've probably heard Senator Brown talk about this quite a bit, but I'm with him on this. This is a struggle that we have to win. And we will win this by staying on the battlefield and understanding that we need to pass this legacy of the struggle for statehood to our next generation. So when Pat picked me up, I was soaking wet, tired, but I felt good that I had at least made an effort to be there yesterday and to be a part of the special day.
Well, thanks for that. And I got to straighten you out on one little detail. We are bipartisan. Maria is one of the world's great Republicans, and that's the behind the show to show that
people,
they're good people on both sides. But
did I say that I wanted to be nonpartisan?
Well, no, we are nonpartisan.
We are
a lot.
Except
but
for
we
me.
We also are bipartisan.
You know me, Bill. I bleed Democratic blue. But, just briefly, I want to tell you about my experience, and then we'll let Maria ask a question, and I'll ask a question. But you know, I got to do this thing on Freedom Plaza yesterday, and we marched to the Lincoln Memorial. I didn't march because I just had surgery on my foot, so they were kind enough to drive me to the Lincoln Memorial. But I was emotional too, Phil, because I got to stand on the steps of the Lincoln Memorial, mm-hmm. right where Dr. King had stood, and give a speech to the crowd. And I just felt so honored to do that, mm-hmm. It filled. There weren't 200,000 people in front of me. I understand that where you were, as a part of the mall you were on, there were as many as 20,000 people. At the Lincoln, there weren't that many, maybe 1,500 or 2,000 people. But still, it was such an emotional thing to stand there on the steps and think about this, his speech, and how, I always say this about Dr. King to young people, because it's really important, as you pointed out, to talk to young people, and it's really important to have people like you talk to young people. But I always say, don't forget that this man changed the world, and he was killed when he was 39 years old.
Yeah,
he didn't change. He didn't live to be an old man. Oh my God! What it would have meant to all of us, I think, if he lived to be 80, 90 years old, but he didn't. But he still changed the world, and young people can change the world, and I hope they get that. So that was my experience. Maria, do you have a question?
Sure, Phil. First of all, as we mentioned before the program, thank you so much for honoring us with your presence. And for that you have done in your life to help make our country a better place and the District of Columbia as well. And also the contributions of your wife, Pat Sloan.
Yeah.
What an amazing team the two of you are. And so I'm curious, I have a two-pronged question. One is the March 31st, 1968 speech that Dr. Martin Luther King gave at the Washington National Cathedral. I believe that you were there and
it was a
sermon called Remaining Awake During a Great Revolution. I didn't know about that, I'm sorry to say, until I read up on you. Can you tell our listeners about what that was like for you? Because he was shot, I think, 4 days later.
Yeah.
Exactly. That's right.
That was
his last
speech. Yeah.
Yes. Well, I was 26 at the time and living here. I'm a native Washingtonian. And I had received my first decent camera at the time, and it was a little Pentax camera from Japan. And when I got that camera, the whole world of photography opened up to me. I was running around shooting. I was shooting pictures of anything that moved, family, going to the National Arboretum, which has been a special place for me. And then about it, and then I was working at the National Education Association, which is still down on 16th and M Street, Northwest. And I was asked by the photographers that we had two staff photographers, and they needed a darkroom technician. And that was my introduction, really, to photography. They, in addition to my full-time position there, I would work after 5 o'clock. I would stay at the building, and I would go into the lab on the third floor and process their film and make prints for the publications for the National Education and other outlets that they sent their work to. And so that really got me moving into photography. Well, just to make a long story short, in mid-March of 1968, I got word that Dr. King was coming to Washington, D.C. And my parents, I grew up in a family where both our parents, I have three siblings, and both our parents kept us aware of the news and things that were happening. And plus, as a aspiring photographer, I spent so much time looking at Life magazine, Ebony magazine, and concentrating on the black and white photos that appeared in these different publications. And so when I found out that he was coming, I talked with a few friends of mine that I worked at the NEA with, and I said, I'm going. And I had a 64 Pontiac. I got in that. I was supposed to meet them there, and I parked up on Macomb Street. You probably know where that is, Mike, up Wisconsin Avenue, and walked down to the cathedral and was able to get in. But later on, what I found out that they had stopped the entry because the place was packed, so they had loudspeakers outside. Well, Dr. King, I was near the rear, and I heard him give the message, and he started saying, remaining awoke. And he used it back in those days. He was cool because he used the word awoke like our young people are using it today. So Dr. King was a little ahead. He was many years ahead of the use of that term. And he just talked about Rip Van Winkle and how Rip Van Winkle fell asleep and slept for 20 years. And when he first went to sleep, the King George in England ruled the colonies. When he woke up 20 years later, George Washington was the president of the United States. And Dr. King was trying to share with us that we're living a revolution every day. And what side of the revolution are you going to be on, especially where justice and humanity is concerned? And I walked away from that as a 26-year-old young man. I said I understood just about everything that this man said. My parents told me, don't take a camera. That's the sad part of it. I didn't take my camera. And I regret it. I regret that to this very day. But anyway, leaving there so excited and honored to just be in the same place he was in, and hearing him talk about his proposed Poor People's Campaign, which actually was at that time was planned to come into Washington on the weekend of Mother's Day. But Dr. King was assassinated 4 days later in Memphis, Tennessee. So he never actually got to experience that Poor People's Campaign. And then I was also here to just see the response to Dr. King in terms of how people just reacted with the anger and sadness, anger, all the emotions that can come out of a human being, came out of me, came out of many of my friends in the community. And the one that was talked about on the news at that time was the destruction that took place. And if I hadn't had my camera and parents that really, I think, helped me, deal with life, I think I could have easily had been part of the negative part of that response to Dr. King's death. And at
so
that
your
time,
camera
Go ahead. I'm sorry, Maria. Stop anytime.
No. My interruption was because it sounds like your camera helped liberate you from the negativity create a better place for us, because your images, well, as they say, you know, a photograph is 1,000 words, right? So you could probably maybe get some of your angst out through your art and show people the suffering.
That's right. You hit it right on the head, because I tried to go out the night of his assassination, but everything downtown was quickly, the curfew came into existence. That was on a Thursday night, and so I didn't really go out in the streets until Saturday morning, April the 6th. And I spent at least 4 hours walking around D.C., my hometown, and seeing just what had happened. And it just hit me. I just stood there. I think it was at 9th and Rhode Island Avenue. And then I stood there and I said, you know, this is D.C. And it really looked like some of the pictures that I had seen in the magazines from World War II and, European countries that were destroyed during World War II. And then I went to my favorite refuge, and I mentioned it briefly before, and that was the National Arboretum. And what that did for me was this death and destruction and this sadness and anger, the Arboretum gave me the opposite. I went to a place of beauty. It was in April, so that was spring. So the crocuses and some of the other springtime plants were in bloom. And I stayed there for about 2.5 hours, and it was at that time that I decided that I was going to use my camera to have my camera be an eye on the things that I discovered, the things that I saw and hopefully would see in the future. And I made that commitment there. So photography, writing, editing, and all those things, the documentaries and all, that was the birth of that, you know, of that art that I was going to be used, that I was going to use and believe I was here to use to record history, especially with the issues and the struggle, the social justice struggle for, particularly for the African-American people in this country. So for these several years, I got involved with South Africa, Free Mandela, rest of the Poor People's Campaign, the Vietnam War. So all of these things I have been a witness to, and also been jailed a couple times. But each time I had to find someone that I trusted in the group to give my camera equipment to, because I didn't know what would happen to it, you know, once I got in to a police precinct. And so I've seen the ups and downs, the pain, but it's been something that I'm so grateful that I've had an opportunity to have the spirit of justice and peace and justice, not just for one group of people, but for the humanity on a whole. And and then later in life, I really got involved with voting rights, because the key to a democracy is a one man, one vote principle. Mm-hmm. And when I got older and understood that may be what's written, you know, in parts of our Bill of Rights and the Constitution, but that's not what has happened as often as it should. And if you call yourself a democracy and you pick and choose who you believe should have the right to vote, then you've already canceled out that idea of democracy, and you have absolutely no right, in my estimation, to send troops over to another country, spreading democracy, and a major part of that of a democratic system is the right to vote. You have no right to do that. And that's one of the most hypocritical things you can do. And that's where my struggle comes now with the system.
Well, let me ask you something, Phil. I was part of the march. You were part of the march that started at McPherson Square. I was part of the one at the Lincoln called Make Good Trouble. And based on, you know, a phrase that just one of the most lovely men I've ever met mm-hmm. in my entire life, John mm-hmm. Lewis, congressman from Georgia, used to yeah. say. And I remember listening to a speech with when they opened the memorial to King, that John Lewis, who was a close associate, gave a speech, and he said his parents begged him not to go with Martin Luther
yes,
King.
They did. Yes.
They begged him. They said, King is a troublemaker. King yes. is he's going to get you in trouble. You know, and I'm a parent. Mm-hmm. So I understand that mentality, right? You want to keep your kids safe.
They want to keep us safe, yes.
Yeah, but that seems to have changed. And I think, thank God it has, because yes. young people, I think, are more active. So what do you think? What do you think about that for young people? You were a young person when you started in all this. How do you think it's changed for young people today? Do you think they're more aware and they want to be more active? Or, you know, do you think that's changed much since you started?
Yeah, I will just tell you, Mike and Maria, what I have understood over these years area of justice is that we never have and never will have a large group of a large number of the population involved in social justice. If you look back and you look at the groups that we may look back now and we will honor, and they would say, you know, NAACP, the CORE, all of the groups that were out there never were made up of a large number of people. The struggle has been done by a few committed people, as you can see with statehood, the struggle for statehood.
Right? Yeah.
You don't have a huge number of people.
Right.
It's a committed few. But what that committed few can do is not give up when there's a setback, but make a commitment that, yes, everybody is not going to hear and appreciate what you're doing, but there's something that dwells within you that goes beyond those who reject you and those who want to call names and even do harm to you, because your mission is beyond just the negative. It's you're there to see something through as much as you can in the time that you have. And what I'm seeing now, I would have to say now I'm seeing at this time more of my white brothers and sisters involved on the streets. Mm-hmm. We always had those. We've had those. Viola Luiso from Detroit, who lost her life in '68 as a march took place from Selma to Montgomery. James Reeb, the minister who was from Massachusetts, and he came down, he lost his life in Selma. So there have always been dedicated white brothers and sisters who have seen a need for this to be a better country that would serve all of God's people, and we cannot deny that. But there are more in numbers. And what mm-hmm. we have to do is not those of us who are out there can't be discouraged, but have to encourage. And often what happens with the movement is that some of us can get narrow-minded, and then as we get older, we become less patient, and we become less patient with our young people, because we forget that we were once young and didn't have the information or hadn't been introduced to the information that would fire us up to be fighting for justice. So we have to change the generational gap, is what I'm trying to say. Sometimes that sometimes that gets in the way. But I have made it a point that when I see a young person, 20, 30, even 15, 10, and I see that they may be interested in what is going on, I have an obligation, if I have the time, to sit and spend time with that person. And if they reject me, I don't collectively say all our young people, all they want to do is just have a good time, because I know at one time I was a youth. So if we're going to be serious about our social justice work, we have to have some kind of love and compassion for the people that we are out here working for.
I appreciate and really respect the fact that you take it on personally as a mantle, because you're one person, one vote speaks to that. One of my adages is one vote, one voice, one paycheck. You know, how you vote, what you say, and how you spend your money matters. All people sometimes say, well, I'm just one person. I was like, yeah, but there's a lot. But to your question, Michael, let's not forget the Students for a Democratic Society, which began in the, you know, with the opposition with the Vietnam War and culminated in October of 67. 100,000 protesters were at the Lincoln Memorial. Those were young people. So I don't think this is new, but I think to your point, Phil, that it's maybe more biracial, people of color and not just white people. And I love the T-shirt that you wear that vote like Black Lives Matter.
Yeah.
Where can we get that, by the way?
Well, you know, there's a do you know Joni Eisenberg? You know her, don't you, Mike?
Yeah, yes, I do.
Yeah, yes. Joni Eisenberg got those T-shirts and offered them to listeners on WPFW, and a few of us made a donation to Joni, because it was her idea. And I don't remember the place. I think I could find who I made the check out to, but it's a company, I think in New Jersey, that produces those T-shirts. But I was able to get one for Pat and myself.
Well, and you know, anybody that's listening, WPFW, which in Washington, D.C. is known as the home of jazz and justice, is a good place to make a donation. And I got to tell you, Maria, I got to be totally transparent here. I was at that march at the Lincoln Memorial when I was a teenager. But
where
I think
are you?
I think I came to meet girls, though. I don't think I think I heard there were going to be, 50,000 young women there. So we came. Of course, we chanted against the war because, my draft status was 1A. But I have to be honest. I think it was more about meeting girls, which didn't happen, by the way.
You're saving myself for Mrs. Brown,
or suckering Mrs. Brown into a relationship. But anyway, I think the fact that media has grown so much, and this is true of you and Phil are both involved in media stuff, but I think that's grown so much. They often talk about how the country got involved when they saw, fire hoses being used on young people and some of the things that went on in the South. Now you and Pat have done a documentary on how Black Americans came to vote after the Civil War. Tell us about that, and tell us.
Okay, I'm glad you asked, Mike. Yeah. That's one of the major current things we're doing now. Mm-hmm. I was down at the Supreme Court. Pat hadn't retired yet from her employment. I went down to the Supreme Court. Wait a minute. Yes, she had too. Yes, she had. I'm sorry. Mm-hmm. Yeah, she had retired. But I went down to the Supreme Court on February the 27th, 2013. That's when they had the oral arguments involving the voting rights case, Shelby versus Holder. And Al Sharpton was there, Joe Madison, John Lewis spoke. I mean, it was just a tremendous crowd there. And they let us in maybe 10, 15 people at a time for maybe 10 minutes for you to just sit for 10 minutes and hear some of the arguments. I was there taking pictures. I did go in got in line and came back out. While I was there, I also met Reverend Barber. Had a long talk with him. This was before he even started the modern day Poor People's Campaign. But I decided at that time that I was going to get a group of people and hold vigils in front of that courthouse between February and June. We didn't know at that time when the decision on this Shelby Holder case was going to be made, but we decided to do that. And we held about 29 vigils for an hour and a half on Sundays and weekdays whenever we could get people out. We had people that come to join us from Selma, Alabama. But one of the disappointing things, and I will say this, and not in anger, we could not get the local churches to respond. Mm-hmm. And we on Sundays made it convenient. We didn't interfere with 11 o'clock service because I was in service. We said from 1:30, anytime between 1:30 and 3, you could come down and join us for 5 minutes, 10 minutes, and everything pretty much fell on deaf ears. But nevertheless, and as I said before, if you're committed, you're not going to get caught up on numbers. You're going to get caught up on the mission. When the court made that decision on June the 25th and dismantled two of the main clauses of the Voting Rights Act, and that was a coverage clause, 4B, 4B, and the clearance, pre-clearance, was Section 5. Once those things were declared unconstitutional, both Pat and I knew that the floodgates would open as far as voter suppression. We knew that. Yeah. That's why we were so angry and devastated by that decision, because there was no reason for that to happen, because just in the prior election for President Obama's second term, there were so many states who were attempting to enact voter suppression laws, but we had the preclearance clause in place where these states and jurisdictions had to go to the federal government, especially the Justice Department, to get okay. That was all over. So we came home, and I just really stewed over this thing for several days. And then I decided, I know this history. I'm a photographer. I do films. So I sat down and put together the first version was 60 minutes. The film is entitled Voting Rights, The Struggle to Be Counted, 1619 to 2013. And what that film does, I've reduced it down to 22 minutes now without losing much of the content. That film traces the long and often brutal struggle by African Americans to gain the right to vote. That goes through the time that African Americans landed on these shores in Virginia, because all we've ever wanted was to be treated as equals. And from the very first days, first introduction, that has not happened. And then the Civil War brought about a real focus on voting rights, because 38,000 African soldiers and sailors and spies died in the Civil War with the hope at that time in our history there would be the right to vote. And that didn't happen until the 1870, when the Voting Rights Amendment, the 15th Amendment, was established, which sounded great, but it did not take care of the problem, because we had the Klan and other groups do everything they could to destroy this opportunity. we did have Reconstruction. And what I'm just saying, that film covers all of that.
In just over 20 minutes is astonishing.
And where can we see it, Bill?
Yes, because what I found, when I found out that there were young people as young as 14, 15 years old who had come to churches and places where we had shown it, and in some of the schools and sororities, young people were there, and they would just be sitting there looking at it and just entranced. And so I said, look, we've done something that we've done. We really now can get to the young people. We wanted them to see this, but we didn't know what impact it would have. So we decided to do, we've done three versions, 1 hour, 137 minutes, and then 122 minutes. And the 22-minute version is what we have been able to do to capture the attention of our young people.
Mm-hmm.
So we did, when we knew that the 2020 president elections were coming, we decided in July of 2020, we put together, because we couldn't take the film around like we used to once the pandemic hit. Mm-hmm. So we found out and got familiar with the Zoom setup. So we started doing voter education seminars right here from the house each Sunday. And Mike, that's how I was getting in conflict. That, you know, when Karen called about the show, I knew that we were doing it from 7:30 to 9, and your program show was aired at 7. So yeah. I couldn't join you then, but we must have reached as many as 10,000-15,000 people from all over the country who joined us on these Zooms, because not only would we show the documentary, we would have a Q&A session. And then we would lead people to the website where we would have, we wanted it to be politically holistic voter education. So we would have voter education terms like filibuster, which we know now is all over the place. You know?
Yeah.
And what is a caucus? How long does your senator serve? How much power does the president have? We just felt that it's one thing to get people to register and vote. What we also wanted them to understand how their government works, so they could be intelligent voters.
And Pat still do these Sunday sessions?
Yes, we're going to be starting back in October, before the midterms.
So how do we get to see that? Tell our listeners how they get to participate in this.
Well, what I would like to do is just leave our cell phone number and our email address.
Go ahead and give us that, and then we will also post it. But let our listeners know how they can get in touch. Because I, for one, want to watch the 22-minute version. I wouldn't mind watching the hour version, but
yes,
I really want to see it. So please tell us how people can get in touch with you, Phil.
Okay. Phil Portlock, you can reach us by phone, Pat Sloan, by phone at 202-271-5495. And the email address is thethirdeye72@gmail.com. And I can also give you the website. And
please,
I'll go slow with that. It's voices, the number four, justice. Your Voices for Justice 72.com. And we have information there, photographs, we have voter education information, and a list of the other films and documentaries that we have done. and Pat does all of the voiceovers.
Okay.
And what does the number 72 mean to you?
It was 72. I was 72 years old when we started the group right around the time of the Supreme Court's decision.
Okay.
Well, and I got to tell you, Phil, the reason that we pre-recorded today is that I'm going to a prayer vigil on Freedom Plaza at 6:30 with a bunch of ministers, and they have not really been involved in our movement for statehood.
Well, that's right.
And I'm going to mention that. I'm going to mention that. Okay. You know, it's time to step up on the plate. Because, look, there are many things that I admire about Dr. King. I admire how brilliant he was, what a great orator he was. But the thing that I admire most about him, when I read Letter from Birmingham Jail when I was in college, was that God was at the center of everything he did.
Same here.
And you know what? You have to have God at the center of this.
Yes.
Maria,
yes.
Do you have another brilliant question?
I do, because I think it's worth noting the high school that you graduated from, Paul Lawrence Dunbar High School, and in the honor that they gave you in August of 2013, what did that mean to you to be the school's Alumni Federation honoring you with its Living Legends Award permanent plaque?
Yes, I tell you, it was, it's hard to put in words. You know, sometimes when people receive, you know, accolades and commendations, they may think that their work is done. And yes, I can just say I'm so grateful now I can slow down. What that did for me was that even fired me up more, because I said, I'm going to live up to this Living Legend honor, because I don't know if a lot of people know that Dunbar High School was the first African-American high school in this country when it was established in 1870, 5 years after the end of the Civil War. It wasn't called Dunbar High at the time. It was called the high school, the preparatory school for colored children, for colored youth. And its first class was held on November the 14th in the basement of the 15th Street Presbyterian Church, right at McPherson Square, where people gathered yesterday.
Well, and it's legendary. Here in Washington, D.C., Dunbar
because it's
is legendary.
A public school, right?
Yes, it
yes,
is.
Yes, yes. And it has a new building that was built in 2013. It opened up in 2013. And that was when they honored 50 Dunbar legends. And I can tell you, I was in the list with Vince Gray, my high school friend, Eleanor Holmes Norton, Dr. Charles Drew. The list goes on. Elizabeth Catlett, the great artist.
Member of a presidential cabinet and the first black graduate of the United States Naval Academy. Yeah.
Yes.
I mean, my goodness.
Yes. Oh, just an enormous Tuskegee Airman, Walter Fauntleroy, who was served as our congressperson for 21 years.
Oh, my gosh.
Yes. I encourage everyone to visit the new school, not just to see my plaque, which they put, in fact, below the wall of honor. There's an honor of Walter Fauntleroy and Dr. Drew, and they're on their plaques and all are on the wall. And right as you walk into the school armory, which is a big open space, right at that wall, somebody decided to put my plaque right there.
Well, you know what?
So I'm honored.
I'm going to go look for the plaque, but
congratulations!
I got to tell you, Phil, I knew you were a living legend the first time I met you. I didn't have to
thank
see
you,
the
Mike.
Plaque.
Likewise, thank you.
You know, and look, we're almost out of time. Believe it or not, Phil.
I know it.
So
I know it.
Is there one last thing you'd like to say? Something that we haven't said? That you know, something we haven't asked you that you'd like to say?
Oh, just one historical piece that I, because I'm a historian, one of the things that I mentioned when I saw Dr. King give his last speech, that same night at 9 p.m., former President Johnson came on the air and announced that he was not going to be a candidate for a re-election.
Wow. Wow, that is a historic occasion. Well, we're about to sign off, and I've got to tell you that I'm honored, and I think I speak for Maria too, to have you on the show. And obviously, there's lots more that we need to ask you and we need to talk about. So if you can, we'll ask you to come back sometime.
I would love to. Could I just say one more thing that I'm proud of?
Please.
And that is, I photographed most of the construction of our Metro Rail system in this region.
Yes.
Well, I'll have to look at that stuff too, because when I was just out of high school, just getting out of high school, I had a lot of friends that worked on the Metro and that were, you know, they did, they were laborers, you know, they built concrete forms and things like that. Well, Phil Portlock, thank you so much for being on the show. Please tell Pat that to give her our regards. We leave the show every week with a song that we dedicate to the person that's been on the show. And it's really hard sometimes to pick that song. But with Phil, it was easy because I don't know that there's a better song for a photographer than Paul Simon's Kodachrome. So we leave you with that song. And Phil, thank you so much for being on the show.
Thank you so much, Mike. And Maria, thank you so much. And to the listening audience.
Yes, and continued success.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Maria,
thank
you. You want to give the last comment?
Just to thank the activism that you and your wife have been engaged in, and your courage and your fearlessness, and the pictures that you took that say what needs to be said without words behind them. Thank you for the power of your art.
Thank you so much, Maria. Thank you.
You're welcome.